Right. Good afternoon, everyone. I call to order this meeting of the Emeryville City Council. Oh, my apologies. It's 3:35 p.m. and I call to order this meeting of the Emeryville City Council Budget and Governance Committee regular meeting that is being hosted here at Emeryville City Hall in the Garden Level, 1333 Park Avenue here in Emeryville. Our next item on the agenda is item two, which is the roll call. I am present.
I'm present as well. This is Susan.
Mayor Carr is also
present.
All members of the committee are present. Item three is public comment. Did we receive any public? We don't have any members of the public here with us to make comment. Do we receive any written comment cards prior to the meeting?
We did not.
Thank you very much. Moving along to item four, which is approval of the October 7th, 2025 regular meeting action minutes.
I hereby move approval of the October 7th, 2025 regular meeting action minutes.
I will second that. I didn't see any changes myself. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Motion passes. Our one action item we have is the election of the committee chair.
I hereby elect Member Welch to continue as the committee chair for the year of 2026.
I accept the nomination and second the motion. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. Motion passes. Six, moving along to information items. Item 6.1, residential landlord and tenant relations ordinance, definition of small landlord.
Thank you, Chair. Chad Smalley, Community Development Director. This is a result of a referral that the City Council made probably a couple months back. I believe it was your referral.
Yes.
To the Budget and Governance Committee to talk about the small and large landlord definitions in our tenant landlord relations ordinance. I've got with me today as one of my guests here is Valerie Bernardo, Economic Development and Housing Manager, to talk a little bit about work we're doing that will address that question, but it is a larger question, a larger endeavor that's going on right now. So I wanted to hand it to her to kind of tell you about, you know, how we plan to approach that.
Thank you. Welcome, Valerie.
Hi. So we have embarked on a tenant protection ordinance project that we're working on that's going to address our just cause ordinance, our tenant protections for our below market income residents, our no-fault remedies, relocation assistance, as well as being able to allow tenants to create an organization, as well as our anti-harassment policy. So that's a part of a larger project that we're working on. We did receive a grant from MTC to support that work. We have a consultant in place. The project kicked off last August. We have gone through, the project is broken up into a couple of different components. We've done a draft assessment of local ordinances from other jurisdictions, looking at what policies they have so we can compare it to ours, as well as what's in the state to identify what the best practices are. We've done some community outreach where we've done surveys of tenants and landlords, talking about what their concerns are related to our ordinance or just dealing with tenant protections. And we are currently in the process of interviewing other jurisdictions to understand their implementation. As a part of that project, when the question came up about the distinction between a small and large landlord, we decided to fold that into the project so that we're not making one-off changes and it can be looked at and examined as a part of the bigger project. Within our current ordinance, we define a large landlord as somebody who owns four or more covered units within the city of Emeryville, and a small landlord as someone who owns four or fewer. The first one is more than four. The second one is four or fewer units in Emeryville. I think the public comment that had been submitted was about having us expand that beyond people who own property beyond Emeryville. Mm-hmm. And so that is part of the research that we're doing as a part of the bigger project. The recommendations will come out from the consultant hopefully by April. Our schedule has gotten pushed a little bit. So our intention is to bring something back to council regarding this by September in regards to what those recommendations are and changes are for the ordinance. As a part of that project, we'll include whether or not there's a recommendation to change that definition. What I have found from when the ordinance was originally adopted was the reason they didn't include landlords outside of Emeryville is the mechanism to determine how would a resident determine if somebody owned property outside of another jurisdiction? And that is a huge burden for a tenant to be able to decide in order to make the determination as to what the relocation payment would be. So I think that's why it was not done in the past. And looking at some of the other jurisdictions that we have already done the research on, most of them do not have a distinguishing between a small and large landlord. The amount of payment is a flat fee. So it doesn't matter if you're a mom and pop owning a rental unit or you're a large landlord, the amount that you pay is the same. So I think we do have that distinction, but we will continue to look to see whether or not that distinction needs to stay and whether or not there are ways to expand that to address people who own properties in other jurisdictions. But that research is underway.
Thank you. Madam Mayor, did you have any follow-up questions for Valerie?
Thank you, Chair. I don't. You are bringing this up more comprehensively in September to us or the council?
To the city council. It will go to the Housing Advisory Committee. I think right now we're projecting June. It could be July. And then the thought would be that it would go to council in September. Potentially, we'll probably set it up as a study session because it is such a large project with big implications that we'll probably do a study session first and then come back for the vote regarding the changes to the ordinance.
I had one kind of clarifying question about the flat rate fee. Now, does that vary by household size or is it
in other jurisdictions?
Yes, the relocation fee. How do they determine it? Is the flat fee is just
household
period? So it doesn't matter how many people. It's like whether it's an individual or it's a couple. They've got four kids.
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
I have not seen a jurisdiction that distinguishes it by size. Some of them do distinguish it by whether or not you're a special category. So if you're a senior, if you're disabled, if you have income under a certain level, some jurisdictions do that. But outside of that, most of them, it's a flat fee that somebody is eligible to receive, and the payment is made on behalf of the household. And so if you have roommates, they have to split it. It's one payment that's made for the entire household, and it's up to that household to decide how it's divvied up.
Okay. Thank you. I did not have any other follow-up questions. Look forward to the study session coming up in fall. And if there's nothing else to that information item, we can move on to item 6.2, state law and city ordinances pertaining to substandard multifamily housing.
Yes, let's do that.
Thank you. Chad again. This also is the result of a city council referral. Bear with me as I bring up my thing. It will work for me. There we go. On May 20th. Back in May, the city council voted, and this was at Mayor Carr's request, a discussion about which at that time was articulated as new laws pertaining to multifamily housing as related to code enforcement and habitability issues. Over time, I determined through correspondence with Mayor Carr that the specific pieces of legislation in question were AB 838 from 2021, AB 548 from 23, and SB 1465, the most recent, from 2024. Each of these relate to habitability and multifamily units and code enforcement, but in different ways. And so the staff report in this presentation goes through each of these bills in turn, summarizes what they do, and then what the implications are for the city in our policies and procedures and how it relates to our existing laws. So going in chronological order, AB 838 was a state law that required an enforcement response on the part of cities and counties to tenant complaints. Prior to this, the city still did respond to these complaints, but this state law requires to happen. So in Health and Safety Code 17970.5, it was added to the Health and Safety Code to say that if a complaint was received, that the city must inspect the unit. And in this law, just the surrounding premises that might be affected. The requirements are to document the findings from that inspection by the code enforcement officer, by the notice to the property owner if a violation is found, and then explain to them in that violation how to correct it. Then it also requires that any copies of this documentation be provided to the complainant at no charge. And the city cannot require the tenants give notice to the property owners that they're submitting this complaint. We cannot require that a tenant be current on rent or otherwise compliant with their lease terms. And we cannot require that they not be in some sort of legal dispute with their landlord, which I think is interesting, because what this says to me is that this law in part was designed to address jurisdictions that have a different approach to code enforcement than us. It would never occur to us to not respond to a complaint from a tenant because they're behind on rent. That just isn't in our ethos here. But so I thought it was interesting that this law included these provisions. And so this was the first law that we looked at. And I'll get into more detail to sort of how these sort of intertwine and intersect with the city in a moment. So the second law is AB 548. This one from 2023 requires that every city and county establish a policy. It's sort of building on that last law that we just talked about. We establish a policy regarding inspection of additional units in multifamily buildings. So this law says that by January 1st of 2025, each city and county had to adopt a policy by which it would determine when conditions, you respond to a complaint on a habitability concern in a unit, in a multi-unit building, how to determine which other units to inspect that might also be affected by the condition you observed in the complaining unit. At a minimum, these policies require that cities, when you can reasonably determine that there might be risk to adjacent units, an example of this could be like rat infestation or something like that, that you at least inspect the adjacent units next door, above and below. And if you find a condition in a unit that is so severe that it and is of the nature that it may affect the entire building, the policy also has to allow to inspect every unit in the building. If in reasonable, judgment, the condition that you're observing is something that's likely to occur in all of the units or in the common areas or something like that. So this bill's up. So first bill says you got to inspect. You got to respond to a complaint. This one says if that complaint's in a multi-unit building and it looks like something that might affect other units, you should inspect those too. You have to have a policy for determining when you're going to do that. The last one, SB 1465 from 2024, expands this even further. So this expanded the definition of residential unit and code enforcement authority and builds on those past two laws as well. So what this did is it revised the health and safety code to clarify that a substandard building includes buildings where that substandard condition exists to the extent it endangers life, limb, health, property, safety, and welfare of the nearby residents as well as the occupants. Prior to this change in the law, it just said the general public as well as the occupants. But this added explicitly to say it could also be nearby residents. It also, and maybe more substantively, expanded these provisions to apply regardless of the zoning or the approved use. So if somebody is living in a building that's a commercial building, they're not approved, it's zoned commercial, and they're using it as a residential unit, these standards still apply, and we still enforce on that basis. It's also the case that, if they weren't approved as residents, it's illegal. That we still have to treat this as a residential unit, respond to the complaint, adjacent units, look at the habitability concerns, and address them accordingly with that same documentation that I mentioned in the first piece of legislation. This law also incorporated municipal code violations explicitly into state enforcement authority, and expanded these provisions around receivership. If you have a particularly egregious case and you're not getting compliance, there's a set of existing state law, even prior to this law, that provided that the city can petition a court to appoint a receiver to fix the problem. And there were some little nuances about how that was done. This expanded those existing provisions to make them a little bit more powerful. Really only applicable to extraordinarily egregious edge case kind of scenarios. So with that, those are the three pieces of legislation and what they did. And if you summarize what the implications of these are for the city, that's what this slide does. So the requirements for the city are that we respond to tenant complaints regarding substandard housing conditions and lead hazards, and that we conduct inspections in response to those complaints, that we ensure those inspections extend to the units that might be reasonably expected to be impacted by the conditions found in the unit from which we received the complaint, that we give the documentation on the complaints and inspection reports to both the property owners and the tenants, that we reinspect them to make sure that the violation is fixed after a procedure, which I'll get into in a moment, and that we apply these standards that I just described, regardless of the zoning or the approved use of that building. You put it all together, this is the implications for the city. So what does the city do? Firstly, all of these laws make reference to Health and Safety Code 17920.3. That is a long list of conditions that establish whether a unit is substandard under the law. And all of those conditions has to be pervasive and severe. But it says things that state law says things like adequate sanitation, adequate heat. There's no objective standard encoded in the state law for most of the conditions that are listed as triggering a substandard condition, housing condition. The International Property Maintenance Code, however, the IPMC, covers all the same areas. And it does establish concrete, objectively verifiable standards for each of those conditions. So an example that I gave, adequate heat. Well, what the IPMC says is you need to be able to maintain a temperature of 68 degrees for a certain amount of time, at measured at a certain level above the ground. Like it's that kind of precision which actually makes these standards quantifiable and implementable. We've long adopted the IPMC as part of the building code, and we do it every 3 years. I don't recall the first year that we did it. That was before my time. I've been here 9 years. But I will say that the most recent version of the IPMC was adopted on November 18th of this year with that overall package of building and fire codes that you as the city council adopted in November. And more specifically, as regards the AB 548 requirement that we develop a policy for adjacent units and multifamily buildings, we did issue on effective January 1st, 2025, per the state law. And I attached it to the staff report. And what that does is it implements that state law virtually verbatim. It says, if cross unit risk is reasonably present, you need to look at all the units that would be reasonably affected by that condition. And at a minimum, the adjacent units above and below and next door need to be inspected as well. A note about process. So in Emeryville, as in most cities across the Bay Area, our code enforcement process is complaint driven. Complaints can come in any number of ways. C-Click Fix is one way that folks can submit a complaint. If they go to the city's website and go through that system, it gets routed to our code enforcement officer, but I'll take this moment to introduce for the committee. We have with us today Nicole Ewing. She was our code enforcement officer. We also have Jason Williams, who is our chief building official and oversees code enforcement, and was with us all 4 weeks. I think it's his fourth week here, so he's new to the city.
I think this is both of your first budget and governance committee meetings since joining the city, so welcome and congratulations. Did either of you have anything to add?
I'll kick it. They're here for questions, and I should have started with that introduction. Okay. I realize that now. Yes. But to continue on, these complaints all get to Nicole somehow. They either through C-Click Fix, folks can just email us. We do have a paper version of the form. If someone wants to print that out or pick it up at City Hall, they can fill it out, or just call. If they call us, it's going to end up with Nicole, and she can initiate a case. When a complaint's received, Nicole conducts a field inspection. It's a typical process to verify. It depends on the violation being reported. And if it's true that there is a problem, we always try, our objective with this process is to get compliance. It's not to beat up landlords. It's to get to the fastest pathway of getting things right. Sometimes, maybe oftentimes, sometimes folks just don't know the requirement. And all it takes is a phone call to say, hey, did you know you need to correct this problem? You have a code violation here. Oh, I didn't know. I'm sorry. I'll go take care of it. Thank you. Okay. And they do when we close it out. If we get a little bit more resistance, or it's like, no, I don't agree, or, you know, things like that, then we move into a formal process, which is issuing a notice of violation. The notice of violation is a term of art that's described in the municipal code, and it describes what those notices have to have. They have to explain what it is that's being violated, a timeline for correcting it, and what those corrective actions are. If you still don't get compliance, even in response to one or more notices of violation, we have an additional level of escalation that can occur within the administrative process, and that is to issue an administrative citation. This is in the first chapter of the municipal code as well, and it's basically the same as a notice of violation, except now you have to pay a fine. And the fines are established in the master fee schedule that you adopt every year for violations of the building section of the municipal code, as well as the planning section. Those violations currently are at $102 for the first violation, that's per violation, by the way, $205 for the second per violation that it has occurred within the 12 months of the one prior, and $513 for each violation of third and more within 12 months of the first violation. So this starts to ratchet up the fines to compel compliance. And that is the process. So in summary, bringing us back to where we were at, these are the items that these pieces of legislation require the city, the implications for the city are that we respond to tenant complaints and conduct those inspections. That's what we do. We have a complaint-based system. When complaints come in, it results in an inspection by our code enforcement officer. We're required to extend those inspections to units impacted by conditions found in the complaints unit. And for that, we have that building inspection policy that we adopted or implemented on January 1st of 2025, pursuant to the assembly bill. We provide documentation. That's our standard practice to the property owners and tenants. That's also included in that same inspection policy. Reinspection of the units to verify compliance is a standard practice implemented through the MOV requirements, which state to the owner what you got to do to correct it and when and how to clear the violation. The reinspection typically is the process that we use, you know, show that you've completed the work. And then apply standards regarding the zoning or approved use. We did that already. We didn't distinguish, you know, based on what the use of the building was. And also that is a infrequent thing to happen where you have a residential use of something that wasn't zoned for residential. Most of every building is zoned to allow residential in some way, shape, or form. But regardless, we comply with state law with regard to that. That concludes my presentation, survey, I guess, of the state of play as regards these laws. I have Jason and Nicole here, as well as myself, happy to answer any questions you may have about any of this.
Thank you very much for that comprehensive presentation and breaking down the history of the assembly bills and how we got here, and also how this has been addressed in the past. Madam Mayor, since this was your item that you requested to be brought before the committee, I wanted to give you the opportunity to ask any questions of the staff that you may have.
Thank you, and welcome Nicole and Jason. And again, thanks Chad for the presentation. So you summarized it by, in a way, saying that the city is already compliant with the SBs as well, as because we comply with the international IPMC. And that was adopted in November 2025.
The most recent version of it was. We had it also in place earlier, but I'm not sure for how long.
Okay. And it's it is noted on our website somewhere, or?
Because it's part of the municipal code, so it's incorporated through those provisions in the building regulations. I forget which title of the community code it is.
Well, I'm most concerned about the SB 548, because that's the one that talks about, affecting adjacent units. And the reason why I am bringing it up is because you mentioned rodent infestation. Mm-hmm. Rodents are something that travel easily across to the other buildings. In fact, I live at the Watergate, where there have been complaints about that. And I think Nicole has been out there for that. However, I don't believe that there was any cross-building inspection done at that point. It was only that one building where the complainant was, and that's the reason why I'm bringing up the AB 548, mm-hmm. is because it seems like only that building was updated pursuant to the recommendations that were provided. However, there was no AB 548 cross inspection. And I want to be sure that our municipal code incorporates that, because it's the updated law. So I think that it's very necessary. I know it's a huge complex, but I think it warrants, AB 548 warrants the cross building inspection if that happens.
So my understanding of that AB 548 is that if it's a unit that you inspect our surrounding units, mm-hmm. it doesn't apply to going to different buildings. I mean, so if there's no complaint on that building, there would be no expectation to inspect and require the same thing of that building if there's been no complaint that the issue is there. But it would be reasonable to believe that the issue is within the whole building, not other buildings.
Yeah. And so we do, SB 548 tells us how to do something, right? It says you gotta, if you're gonna do this.
The AB 548, I'm sorry, right. I kept calling it SB 548, but it is the
AB 548. Yeah, no, I know what you meant. No, AB 548 is the how. It basically says, like, if you get a complaint, and there's reason to believe, like a rodent infestation, there's reason to believe that it's not just going to be in that unit, you're sharing these walls, then you need to inspect adjacent units. And so that's why we did change our policy in response to that.
And that was in November 2025?
No, that was done prior, because it needed to be effective by January 1st of 2025. And so that is the memorandum that's attached at the end of the staff report that was issued out to the department, and Nicole, effectively Nicole is the only person we have designated to do this. So to actually make that a part of her normal inspection response routine.
So when I read the AB, it seems to me that it said something about it being applicable to cross building versus just
cross unit, cross units. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So it is cross unit.
And then it says you can inspect every unit in the building if an issue is found that needs to be, that is expected to be beyond just the adjacent units. It leaves it up to the discretion of the city, because there's a wide range of things that can create a substandard condition.
Yeah.
Some things are obviously only affecting one unit. Some things could affect all of the units. And so we apply best judgment based on the type of violation, the type of building, and how it's configured to determine how far to extend the envelope of inspections. And at a minimum, we have to inspect the adjacent ones. But it is up to us to whether to go to the entire building or not, depending on the situation.
Yeah, You're talking about discretion and about the city's discretion. So what I'm thinking is that if the other people in other buildings, adjacent to that building, wanted the same updates, they would potentially have to make.
They could just make a complaint and that would trigger that.
Yeah. And so it would be complaint oriented.
Yeah.
And the same thing with lead, right?
Potentially, it's a little different because it would depend on the circumstances, right? Yeah.
It's not that lead migrates easily to other buildings. So it would be a very, very different animal, no pun intended.
Exactly. So. If you had a wing of a building that was built in 1962 and then a wing of a building that was built in 2002, you got flaking paint in the old side of the building. We're definitely going to, you know, that it's clearly a localized problem that's restricted to that. But if you have an entire building and they all have the same finishes in the common area and it's flaking in this area, then it presumably is flaking in the other areas and we should check that out. And so that's why you have this flexibility built into it, because there's such a wide range of circumstances. Yeah.
So if we are compliant already, I suppose there's really, your recommendation says there's really nothing we have to do to upgrade it because
That's right. I do want to point out, though, that when you take these laws together, it did shift the way cities interact with multifamily buildings and code enforcement in general. So there's been, you know, that's a 5-year period we're talking about, but you can see how each successive step has enhanced and enhanced and enhanced the responsibilities and also the tools that we have to intervene into multifamily code enforcement. So it is a different world than it was 6 years ago as a result of state law. Now, it wasn't a seismic shift for the city of Emeryville, because we already did have a responsive division that was responding to complaints. But now we have more tools to enforce on it and more like backing of state law as a result of this, which has made it better and makes it much more clear what, you know, that we have the ability to compel landlords to fix these problems. And so, yeah, you're correct. My recommendation is that we continue to do what we're doing because we are in compliance with the state law and adapting to our processes to it.
So my question always has been, because cities can do more than just what the state law says. What you mentioned was it is discretionary. It's up to the city whether or not we go and inspect the whole building. What I was trying to get to is, what can we do more for our constituents in this city? Because it seems to me like we've always been keeping abreast of the trend. Mm-hmm. And then the state law comes and seems that we are compliant or we are in compliance. What I'm trying to get to is, what can be done more proactively? So what I'm trying to get to is, rather than it being discretionary, for example, in the case of the rodent problem, when you know that the pests easily migrate to other buildings, especially when they cannot get it to, you know, get whatever they need at that building where it has now been bolstered and taken care of, could we do anything more proactively? Because obviously cities can, they have the, just like cities can do more than the state can do. HOAs can do more than what the city can do, which many HOAs do and some don't. So what I'm trying to get to is that part, rather than it being discretionary, is there something we can do more to be more proactive for our constituents?
I think there's two different things there. I think it would be difficult to create a rule that completely removed discretion from the equation, only because there's such a variety of situations to deal with. Beyond rodents, this deals with mold, lead, sanitation, trash. I mean, there's just a plethora of things. And then layered on top of that, we have a very wide diversity of building types, ages, size, and configurations. So I think it'd be hard to build a rule, an objective rule, for each of these cases that would remove all discretion from the process.
So I would like to clarify that I'm not asking that discretion be removed from the process. What I'm trying to get to is there something that can be done more proactively, especially when you know it's like, let's say, Pacific Park Plaza, and you find something there, and it's just one building, and it's very easy to go ahead and just inspect just one floor, but because it could be pervasive to the whole building, it would be, rather than just making it discretionary, oh, we've taken care of this floor, should we go in and just inspect the building for the, you know, whole, just sample it. You don't have to inspect every single unit, but if this is happening on floor 15, could it also be happening on floor 4? You know, can just a random sampling, and then you find that there's a trend, you can go ahead, because it is discretionary, you would do it as a discretionary thing, right?
Yeah,
but what I'm trying to get to is, sometimes the discretion is, it was our discretion, so we went only to floor 15, not floor 4. What I'm trying to say is there something that can be done by the city where something happens, let's say on floor 15, and that triggers it for the city to inspect, let's say it's a plumbing issue, you know, the whole complex in Florida just fell apart because there was one plumbing issue that could not be addressed for many years, and it was pervasive through the whole building. So what I'm trying to say is, can the city do more than just that one thing just triggers, we need to go ahead and inspect these other buildings. Here's, and now we inspected floor 15, now we inspected floor 4, same problem. We inspected floor 18, same problem. Looks like you HOA now will need to go ahead and make sure all of this is inspected and submit a report. And we come out and redo an inspection on different sampling of floors, not 4 and 19 that we did. Now, all of a sudden, you take the burden on and you go ahead and fix the problem so that the building doesn't fall on our watch. And then because you have protected yourself as a city at that point, you're like, we went and inspected floor 4 and floor 19. But
same problem.
There's a trend here, and now you, management, need to take care of this. What is it that we can do more to be more proactive so that something like Florida does not happen here in Emeryville? I think Pacific, just like it's well managed, and they would take care. They would take your recommendations to heart and then let you inspect more than once. So that's what I'm trying to get to. I'm not trying to taking the discretion away. I'm saying keep the discretion. It's a beautiful thing. It's a great thing. But now you can use the discretion. What I am thinking is the discretion should not be something that constrains us.
Oh, I understand now. Yeah. I don't view it as constraining us. Like, I actually think it's empowering. Because the law actually, and our policy explicitly says, hey, if you see a problem that is likely to be a building-wide problem, then you can look at all the units. And I don't know if you have anything to add to this. Like, if you encountered an issue like this hypothetical that's being described, that is what we would do.
I do have something to add.
Yeah.
So this was the beauty of getting the IPMC. I can remember when we didn't have it. So we get in the matter of, is this a civil matter? Is this something the city's responsible to respond to? IPMC gave us some minimum prescriptive measures on what's considered, you know, habitable and uninhabitable. Gave us a good measure and something to point to. But it's really a two-way prescriptive measure that protects the tenant, also protects the landlord, that if they meet these minimum standards, they're in compliance also. You know, so as far as developing something beyond, I think it would be reasonable to go ahead and ask, can we look? But it also protects, if they wanted to turn around and say, what gives you permission to go into my other 11 buildings, when we've you know, satisfy an issue isolated into one building, you could see where that could be a stance that a property owner may take. Interesting enough, it gets to the point where all of these things are realistic. These situations are out there. Most of them, I'll say, you get out there and they're real issues. People have mold, people have things, and when you realize they're living in those conditions, yeah. The flip side of it is, even though we're code enforcement officers and building inspectors, we're not mold specialists, we're not lead specialists, we're not. So sometimes you have to bring in third-party specialists to verify the conditions. So I may go and peek into cabinets and be looking for, you know, things that rodents leave behind, but there may be a lot more to that to verify how severe the case is. So now you're putting that property owner in a position to constantly be trying to meet these needs because of complaints. We get in a weird little balancing act of how far to make them go. So once we establish these minimum standards, to me, I see that as providing protection both ways to the tenant and the property owner to say, I've met your minimum. You see what I mean? The building standards, you could only do something more restrictive for climatic, geologic, or topographic reasons. So you have to prove there's something special about Emeryville in one of those three categories, take it to the Building Standards Commission, prove that it's something specific. So say if we wanted to outlaw natural gas and go all electric, you know what I mean? We can't just do that out of preference. We have to actually do an analysis and a study, show where, you know, why it's considered more restrictive than the state standard. Hopefully that kind of helps. Of, I'm thinking in my mind that the property owners could point to this too and say, why are you now going into every one of my buildings? You know?
Yeah, but that's exactly where I am coming from, right?
Yeah.
So what you are saying IP, the International Code of
Property Maintenance Code.
Of Property Maintenance Code is what gives you the topographical, geological, or
That's an international
minimum
standard for sanitation, heating and cooling, egress, all kinds of different conditions. Even if it's an attractive nuisance, a burned home, fence it, board it up, those types of things. Or if you don't have that adopted, you could have somebody potentially leave attractive nuisance. When I was a little kid, I'd be in a burned home. You know, we'd be in there, you know, checking out the adventure of running through it. So it gives you measures on how to properly secure that structure. But definitely super helpful because we haven't had it, but maybe for the last three code cycles.
So that's exactly what I'm getting to. What you point out too is that that is what should trigger it. That should be the trigger that you said right now is discretionary, right? And you have to have
a step.
You have to have a balance.
Right.
Well, that's the part that I'm trying to do is the property owner may say to you, well, I met the minimum. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is it should not be the minimum where the city is concerned because you're protecting other residents, other constituents, other tenants in the city. That is not the minimum. The city can raise the minimum is what I'm trying to say. The HOA can raise the minimum. The minimum does not have to be that international code or the state law or the AB or the SB. The minimum can be raised by the HOA. The minimum can be raised by the city. That standard is what needs to be met. In other words, what I'm saying, the city, instead of just having a discretion or saying, well, the property owner is just going to push back against the AB and say, you've met the minimum, why are you now venturing into my other properties? So you've identified the problem that what is the city going to do about that? The city can go ahead and do more than that. Mm-hmm. What the city can have the cards to say, you know what, there is an issue on 15th floor. So this gives us the ability to go into other random floors to identify that problem. If the city goes ahead and establishes that minimum authority to go, that's what gives me the power to go into your other or for random inspection. And if it's the same trend is found, then we need for you to go ahead and give us this data. We'll come back on such and such date and do another thing for 3 other random floors.
Yes.
You are hereby notified of that. So what I'm trying to say, the city can erase them. Every governing body can erase the minimum. And that's thanks for identifying the problem, because that was exactly where I was trying to go into.
Yes.
I was trying to go into the pushback that you may have, saying we have measure minimum, but you know what? You can now go in there. What I'm saying, the city can do more. The HOA can do more. Our HOA does more when we have this problem with the one, the short-term rentals. We have, the HOA does more than just what the city does, that you can't have short-term rentals. So what I'm saying, every governing body can do something more. So when I asked for this item back then, I was actually aware of the ABs of what they said, but I wanted to know what the city can do more than just.
But you mean that as we're completing 2 different things here. So there's the standards, the IPMC, which is what it is. There's the assembly bill, which requires us to inspect additional units and gives us the ability already to inspect all. And we
all of them in one building, right?
Yes. And we inspect and we make that determination and based on our professional judgment of what the particular right situation is. So we already have the ability to look at the entire building.
But not the other building.
Well, so this is as regards multi-building complexes.
Yeah.
We can evaluate the law to see if we have the ability to expand inspections for various habitability concerns when the buildings are detached.
Because
I don't know the answer to that, frankly, off the top of my head.
I totally understand that. I think every jurisdiction will have a different response to that, because that particular problem is not addressed by the AB right now. So
not explicitly. So we should understand how we're going to interpret it as regards multi-building complexes. I will say that we will always exercise professional judgment in deploying this, because we're not going to do something unnecessary and inspect every building in a neighborhood for a localized situation or something like that. We're going to have to deploy some professional judgment based on our experience and our understanding of what the situation is. Right.
I'm not taking away your professional judgment or your discretion. I think those are very important things that you should have as your tools. What I'm trying to say is there should be some deterrent value. There has to be some, for example, what I'm trying to say, there has to be, if you find something in, let's use the same example of the floors.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's the same building, not a multi-building, or maybe that's a poor example.
Because we can do that now. We can look at all of the units in Pacific Park Plaza.
Let's go back to Watergate, or let's go back to the ones that are or Glass House. They are multi and they are smaller multi
closer together too.
Yeah, multi building complexes, right? Mm-hmm. And closer together. Let's say Glass House has one building that has this infestation, right? And then you go, is there a way for you to have discretion to go into the other building? Or you do it as a discretion, but you choose not to exercise the discretion. What I'm trying to say is at that point where you have gone into that one building, it should trigger for the landlord or for the management company that this city is serious about this. It, and you know what? They can go into this other building. It is, nothing is going to prevent them into going. Something that is more proactive. Again, your discretion and professional judgment will never be taken away. Right, it will be a huge supplement. But at
the, we have the ability to do it.
At the same time, it gives you authority and the power to use that discretion in a way where, Jason, your point is that you raised very well, is not, is addressed right away in the law, in the ordinance. It is already addressed there, you know. So let's say, for example, now if we are going to another level of government, the city has something that says that you can now go into Glasshouse Building 2 because you had a problem in Glasshouse Building 1, and you choose to go into Building 2 and Building 100. Because you want to see whether it's a problem across the board. And if it is, then you have the discretion under city ordinance. Because it was a problem in Glasshouse 1, you can go to 2 and 100. And then you can notify the management company saying, you know what, problem over there is in 2 and 100. Fix it. We'll come back in a month. Awesome. And we'll go and inspect 3 random buildings just to make sure that this is, that's the part that I'm getting into. The, you now don't have the discretion or professional, you can't do that based on just professional judgment or discretion. However, you can do it under, if there is an ordinance. That's the part where I'm saying we can be more proactive without taking away judgment, without taking away discretion. And that give the tenants more power, more authority, especially those who cannot stand up for themselves, who are too old, who are too disabled, who are too fragile to go ahead and they may have Alzheimer's, they may have Parkinson's, they may not have people looking after them. Our city has a lot of the older population that lives here. And I think we owe it to those people to do something a little bit more than that, where the substandardness of the thing should not be limited to, well, you know, you inspected my property, and what gives you the power to, this is what I'm asking for. Yeah. What I'm asking for is a study to go and see if they can be something done more proactively and done as an ordinance by the city.
I do not. So I think that the first step, we need to understand whether we already have that ability.
Yes, please, right. Absolutely find
because
out.
We may not need an ordinance. I don't know where this ordinance would live, first of all, but we may not need an ordinance in order to do this. We may simply need a conversation with the city attorney in understanding whether those provisions that, not just in AB 548, but the others as well, give us the ability to inspect multi-building complexes when we believe that a condition occurs in multiple buildings. I think if we get that question answered in the affirmative, that yes, the law gives you that ability as it is today, I think that it's as straightforward as us revising our multi-building inspection policy, which is an internal policy that we have publicly available for building owners. To your point, putting them on notice that, hey, we're going to look at your other buildings. If we find a condition, we can make that, we can easily incorporate that into that provision. And that's a much more quicker, responsive way of getting to the end goal that you would like to see.
That's fine. I mean, I'm open to that as well. I mean, if there isn't, if it all it needs is just the amending of the policy to go into another sampling of the multi-building, that's definitely an easier fix, and it's a better fix.
Yeah, and faster. Yeah.
And I think that itself, if you put it out there for people and you are proactively, you know, addressing it for those people who are too old, too fragile, or too weak to go ahead and address it on their own, they already have this problem addressed by the city.
Yeah.
Just with the policy.
Yeah.
If you already have that, or if you can amend and update it, that's perfectly fine.
Perfect.
And that if we don't have that, or if we need something more, then let's go the next step.
Right.
And that's what I'm asking for. So yeah, what is it that's needed from this body to get there?
Just that direction.
Then you have
it. I've got it super clear, and I have a process to go through for to resolve this. So that's very straightforward. And
we don't need any motion or just direction is enough.
No, it's an information item, and that's sufficient for.
Okay, that's perfectly fine.
I guess my thought is, what limits it to just the complex? So if there's an issue and you see it in one building, and there's another building that's not a part of the complex, do we not include that? So what is the limitation to this requirement? Because I would assume that if you're gonna do the whole complex, then what is it to say that you shouldn't do the building that's on the along the side of it that's not a part of the complex?
Thank you for bringing that up, Nicole, because that's a very important and valid point. Because for those people, let's say Emeryville is full of single family residents, and let's say that's an issue on let's the 47th and the 40th streets. Where they have single family residents. Some of them are multi-unit and some of them are they're not related. Mm-hmm. That's a very good point because a lot of older people and a lot of people that are fragile, they live along those. So what I'm saying is that should be the impetus for you too. It should not be limited to just one complex. Thank you for identifying that problem and bringing it up because people who are living on the 40th, 47th, and all those streets, if this, let's say 40th has two big buildings and they are separate, I think separated by the whole street, they are separated. And let's say they have a rat infestation problem in Bridgewater. And then all the rats go and migrate to Avalon because Bridgewater has done everything you told them to do. And the rats are now happily living in Avalon. So... So what I'm saying is that should trigger for you to like have something in our code enforcement that goes and says, you know, by the way, Bridgewater has notified us of this. We may come and inspect you unless we suspect there might be a problem there, and we can inspect it. If there isn't any problem, please give us a notification saying there's no problem, sign and, you know, sealed. Here it is, notification by Avalon, no problem. Then your job is done. You've protected yourselves. And then all of a sudden, 2 months later, John Doe Senior called and says, you know what? Rats are eating all my food. I'm no food. And, you know that thing is not valid. And you can go in there.
In that case, we could anyway.
Yeah.
Right. Because
now you have a complaint. So that's what I'm saying. It's like you have, and the same thing with 40th, 47th, and those single family residents saying that, by the way.
So we'll look at both.
Yeah.
There's probably legal differences between them.
There will be legal differences.
But I'll investigate our state of authority to inspect when we suspect an issue. And I'll work on that with the city attorney's office and then come back with either revisions to the, to make explicit that we do have it, or I'll tell you we don't. Either way, this committee.
Yeah, that's completely fine. I mean, I if you can address it at policy level, I think that'll be great. If something more is needed, especially for the example that Nicole raised, mm-hmm. there might be some nuance that needs to be addressed by the city. Yeah. And I would like to have the people, the tenants, the constituents in our city to have those tools mm-hmm. in a proactive manner. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I'm saying that, corporations, and to your point, Jason, yes, it's a private property, private landlords, we protect them as well, we protect the residents. Corporations will always have more attorneys. Corporations, I work for a corporation, corporations will always have more resources. That old lady will not have anything but the city to depend on. And that's the reason I think we need to go ahead and revisit this.
Great. Perfect. I have directions, so I appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you all for raising the wonderful questions you did and all the, nuances that can be raised. Really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Cool. All right, well, that moves us on to item 7, which is future agenda items. Looks like we have one, which is reviewing the fees for the pet license. Is there any movement on that at all? Madam Mayor, did you have any
I have no idea about this review fees for pet licenses.
I think there was an incident with a pet, and I know this was a concern of Councilmember Pryforce, is that he wanted to, we had kicked it down here. So that is a future agenda item. I do not own a pet, so I'm unfamiliar with the pet licensing process here and in other jurisdictions.
If there is any movement, let us know. Or is this a placeholder item?
We're gathering some more information, and we'll hopefully bring it back in the near future once we have the additional information.
Wonderful. Thank you. Item 8, announcements and member comments.
I do have a comment about, you know, the time of the meeting. I'm so sorry, but this one doesn't work for me so much, and I have to really push it to come here. Can we change it to a Tuesday where we don't have a council meeting, and maybe change it to 4 o'clock, since we usually go for about an hour?
I know when it comes to scheduling the meetings, we can be a bit flexible since it is a committee meeting. So just future reference when scheduling, just know that the Tuesdays on council meetings can be challenging. By myself, I'm actually happy we're ending a little bit early, but my kids and get them together before I got to be back here at 6:30. Just so non-council meeting Tuesdays, and maybe something earlier, midday, early, a late morning, early afternoon.
If you want to do early afternoon, should I have 11 o'clock meetings on Tuesdays? But I guess I could change those.
Well, we could always do a doodle. Correct, Sharon, when it comes to planning the next one. So don't worry. We just know that let's just kind of scrap it in general for the council meeting.
Yes, please, let's do that.
Okay.
That doesn't work very well for me.
You recall what April shared with us?
Go ahead, Pedro.
No, go ahead. I'm going to look and make sure, because I think this committee might have to go back to council. To change its meeting time. It wasn't one of those ones that was able to set it at the beginning of the year. It was already set.
Okay.
So we might have to go back to make a change.
This was one of the ones that was set in our consent calendar?
It was, the times were already set. And so we need to go back and change the resolution saying the schedule is attached. You have to go back to council to change it.
I would recommend, since this next scheduled meeting isn't until May 5th. However, more than likely, we'll need to call some special meetings in the spring because we have some items that we know will need to get to budget and governance that we will confer the city clerk on the process of changing, potentially changing that meeting time from the existing 3:30, especially on those Tuesdays that conflict with council. And if we need to call a meeting to take action by this committee to then feed to city council and make the change, we'll do so.
Okay.
Do the doodle that you've suggested. That will also help us with the special meetings that you may call. Mm-hmm. Then you won't have to reinvent the process, and it will put us on the alert as to when we have to be there. And if you want to do those meetings by resolution because of the budget, we can go ahead and incorporate them as your monthly meetings. I'm not opposed to that at all.
Right. What we might recommend is that at the beginning of the year, we go back to council, ask for the flexibility that the committee can set the schedule at the beginning of the year, so that way we can post it out, and it gives more flexibility to the committee. So that may be something we come back with. But in the meantime, we'll poll and do the special meetings.
Which has been the practice of the special meetings, kind of fielding availability.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. Well, if there are no further questions, announcements, or other things, okay. Well, the time is 4:39, and this meeting is adjourned. The next regular scheduled meeting is May 5th, at possibly time to be determined. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you all at 6:30.